Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And yesterday at the St. Patrick's Day breakfast, the Attorney General, who wants to be governor, had this to say.
Whenever we were in trouble, Deval Patrick would, almost like Superman, come out and put that MEMA vest on. So I have my pink Shima vest.
Okay, here with us in Studio 3, very sadly not wearing her Shima vest, but decked out in a green scarf and a green sweater and a green bracelet, is the Attorney General of the Commonwealth. She is running for the Democratic nomination for governor. Attorney General, welcome. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Jim. And people laughed after that. You cut the laughter.
There was some laughter.
There was
modest laughter, yes.
It was pretty good laughter where I was.
Here's what I want to know, Attorney General Martha Coakley, because I once did a roast for Tom Fitter, and actually it was the most mortifying night of my life.
On television.
It was
horrible, I watched.
Horrible. I mean, it can't be much fun to go. I mean, I know you have to do these things because you're a politician in Massachusetts. Everyone makes a big deal about the St. Patrick's Day breakfast. But this can't be your favorite day of the year.
Well, you know, I have a whole new attitude about these roasts. Uh-huh. And it is, they're there. You do them. You may as well have a good time.
Uh-huh.
And so yesterday's breakfast was fabulous, actually. I thought Senator Dorsina Forey just rocked the whole way through.
She's a lot of enthusiasm.
It moved quickly. It was on time. It was actually a lot more fun than I've had in the past at that. And I was up in Lowell this morning. I had a good time at the breakfast because I'm just sitting back and enjoying myself.
Do you have any science background, by the way?
What do you mean by that?
Well, here, I want to ask you a question. A scientist until yesterday thought that the nanosecond was the shortest measurable unit of time. I would say it was the time that it took for Deval Patrick to leave after he told us. Would you say that I'm right on that count?
He certainly was eager after his funny bit to exit.
Yes, he was.
I will say that. He had a big smile on his face as he left, actually.
You know, did I miss it? Because I didn't see the whole thing. Was Congressman Joe Kennedy there?
No, he was not.
Oh, how come he wasn't there?
Well, some of the members of the only member of the House was Mike Capuano.
No, and Steve Lynch.
Oh, of course, Lynch. Of course, yeah.
Maybe he didn't feel well.
Well, they don't have,
remember, it is also a district thing. We have those senators there because they're statewide. It's Steve Lynch's district, and I think Michael Borderson has some probably part of that district.
Okay. Martha Coakley, every poll we have seen, you're crushing your Democratic colleagues. But the conventional wisdom, which may be proven or disproven, and it's come June when the convention happens in Worcester.
That's conventional wisdom.
Steve Grossman is going to stand up and claim victory amongst the thousands of activists. If that conventional wisdom is proven right at the convention, what does that say about the sort of the grassroots part of your campaign?
Well, first of all, we're focused on the grassroots, and that is whatever conventional wisdom is, it changes day by day. I don't think anyone is quite sure what will or won't happen at the convention, but our focus has been on getting our 15%, which we have. We're more than happy where we are with caucus delegates. There are a ton of uncommitted delegates. Mm-hmm. And every one of the five now Democratic primary candidates are focused on getting out there, telling our jokes. This is St. Patrick's month, of course, after caucus month. And so, you know, it's a long time till June. I'm just focused on making sure we touch base with folks who are activists, who are delegates, and more importantly, what's going to happen in September. It's the primary we're focused on also.
Speaking of Treasurer Steve Grossman, he's made a couple of charges about your flip-flopping on positions. And one of them, he says you flip-flopped on, is giving licenses to illegal immigrants. What is your position on giving licenses to illegal immigrants in Massachusetts, Martha Coakley?
My current position, and it has been a position well before the Treasurer wrote us a letter about it, was that since I have heard in the last, I'd say, 2 years probably, and more so on the campaign trail, obviously from folks in the community, but also from police chiefs and other elected officials, that their focus on public safety, making sure we can know who people are and that they're prepared to be on the roads, indicates that since the federal government hasn't done what it should do. I support the DREAM Act. I think Washington should have done something a long, long time ago on this. I still hope they will. They haven't. Many states, as you've seen, are moved in many directions to accommodate the reality of a lot of people here who are working hard, paying their taxes, not getting into trouble. So I said, look, I'll consider this. I'm open to it. I haven't totally changed my mind, but I think as every candidate should do, we should listen to what our constituents want, what's going to be in the best interest of public safety.
So it's evolving, to use the word that Barack Obama once used around gay marriage. But I don't understand, if it is evolving, what you need to know to get there. When you read the arguments in favor of this, I drive on the road, you drive on the road, Marjorie does. There are 100,000+ people driving on the road who not only don't have licenses, allegedly undocumented workers, illegal immigrants, who in many cases don't have insurance. So when they hit me, I am really in deep you-know-what. at this stage, as long as it makes clear the legislation, which the proponents say it would, that it would give them no other rights. It would state quite clearly it was solely for this purpose. If you could craft it along those lines, or that's what the legislature does, what argument is there against it except for the fact that people go crazy when they hear the word illegal?
You know, first of all, I was up in Lowell this morning. I started up there in 1980. And we had a lot of people. Most of the people were driving unlicensed, unregistered, uninsured, were perfectly good citizens who just didn't bother to do it. So there is that issue, I know. I don't think there's a greater percentage of folks who, you know, are taken off the road or who are driving without having the appropriate backup, but there are a lot of people who don't do it anyway. My point is this. The discussion is an appropriate one to have now since we haven't passed the federal legislation. I know there's a discussion even in the communities about what do these licenses look like. Are they designating you as someone who's different from everybody else? Are they not? I think it's a good discussion.
If they did, and they did have those kinds of limitations, and your governor in January and the legislature puts on your desk, do you sign it?
I think if it gets there and I have done the appropriate homework that I'm doing now, I said I will consider that if that's what makes sense in all of our communities to keep people safe, particularly on the roads, but in other ways.
She's the Attorney General. She is Martha Coakley. She's with us until about 1 o'clock.
I want to get rid of all this Grossman stuff at one time. Steve Grossman is, of course, the state treasurer, and he has, in what people have noted, is a little bit of the breakdown of the politeness among the Democrats. Usually Democrats going after Republican. Now, because you are leading significantly in the polls, the treasurer is being tougher, challenging you to some of your positions. So one of the things he also says is you have changed your mind on the three strikes bill, the Melissa's bill. We should explain to people, and you should, actually, because you're the Attorney General. There's a lot of confusion about this. There's Melissa's bill, which was named, I believe, for
Melissa Gossel,
who was murdered by a raped and murdered, actually, by a man with a long, long record
of violent crimes.
And her father fought heroically. Les Gossel. I apologize. I should know that because I've interviewed him myself. Les Gossel fought heroically to get the law changed up on Beacon Hill. Melissa's bill. Is that the same as the three strikes you're out, or what is the deal with that, and where do you stand on Melissa's bill and or three strikes and you're out?
Yeah, so let me tell you what Melissa's bill does. It means that people like the man who raped and murdered Melissa Gossel brutally will not be able to be eligible for parole with 27 violent crimes on his record. It means that people like the guy who was eligible for parole and who killed Officer John McGuire will not be eligible for parole with certain kinds of violent crimes when they are repeat offenders.
So that's Melissa's bill.
Yes, no
okay.
more nor less than that. That, to me, is what I support. I think that is what most people support. Surprised the treasurer doesn't support that bill. And that is, to me, something very different from what other states have or what was a prior version of Melissa's bill that would have misdemeanors or any kind of crime saying, oh, if you get in trouble three times, then you're not eligible for parole. That's not what we have in Massachusetts. That's not what this bill is. And what I support is something that I think most people support for public safety.
And for clarification, I think Martha Coakley spoke to this. The bill lays out, 46 specific offenses that would be the third act? It's in the legislation that would trigger the no parole for your third serious offense. This is the Massachusetts law. You know, Martha Coakley, I've been talking to you, I would say, for years about the following topic. So I'm going to bring it up again because it really struck.
And you like to repeat yourself.
I do. I like hearing myself talk about things that I care about. And if you choose to respond, that's fine to know. We've discussed this for years. I continue to be stunned by the pathetic record of the most progressive state in America, which I consider to be the state you were running for governor in terms of electing women to executive offices. There are, by my count, 6 women ever have been sent to Congress by Massachusetts. 2 of them are serving now, Elizabeth Warren and Catherine. Oh, 3. Catherine Clark and Nikki Tsongas.
We have 3. It's getting better.
And so 3 now, 3 ever leading up to Nikki Tsongas winning, whatever number of years ago. Maybe a half dozen constitutional officers, you, Jane Swift, who obviously ran lieutenant governor is a different deal, Evelyn Murphy, Shannon O'Brien, I don't know who I'm missing. Why?
Suzanne Bump. No,
of course, Suzanne Bump. Okay.
2 women, 2 constitutional women.
So maybe a dozen total between Congress and constitutional officers in 200 and some years of a progressive state. Why? This is the question I ask you all the time. What's the possible explanation for that? And 2, you have to worry when you're home at night alone. Well, not alone. You say to yourself, there is a bias. There is a demonstrated bias against women being elected to higher office. I know you're shaking your head, but tell me why I'm wrong. The facts prove it out.
Well, first of all, I think it's getting better, Jim, and I am encouraged with the progress even recently. Look, we had a terrific St. Patrick's Day breakfast hosted in a marvelous way by Senator Linda Dorsey-Nefori. I was up in Lowell this morning. Senator Eileen Donohue was the head of that breakfast. I see on this campaign trail support not just from women but from men. I got a call today from someone who said, you know, I'm supporting you because I have a 13-year-old daughter, and I want her to see the future that it should be, that we have women as governor, we have women business leaders, we have women on the bench. So it's taken a while, I think, but I see a change, and I see a big change from 4 years ago.
So the place where we seem to agree, even if you don't agree about where we are currently, how did it take so long for there to be the progress that you're citing in a place? I mean, when you lost, for example, how many people, I know you, I can't believe I'm bringing this up because I can't stand when people keep doing it. I'm about to do it anyway. Well, why did
Jim,
Martha
this is the definition of insanity.
It is.
You keep asking the same question and hoping to get a different answer.
But you know what? It seems to me in the state, every time a woman loses in a serious race where she has a real chance, well, it's not because there was a good reason there. She wouldn't. Martha Coakley didn't do what she was supposed to do outside of Fenway. I don't care if it's true or not. It's almost not irrelevant. What's her face? Who was the former lieutenant governor running against Duvall the first time? Curry Healy. She didn't do so. There's always an excuse why that woman wasn't the right candidate, but another woman might be. So why have we had such a horrible history? That we agree on, don't we? We have had a horrible history.
It's been a tough history here, and you and I have talked about this. Look, we have Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire now. We have women governors in other states. Wyoming had a woman governor in the 19th century.
Yeah.
We are an old-fashioned state in many ways. I've said this to you in response to this mm-hmm. question. One foot in the 21st, one in the 18th. You know, politics is very tough here. It's our sport. We love it. Because we often have incumbents who stay for a long time when there's an open seat. There's a lot of people in that queue. Women and frankly, other people have been at the back of that line. But I think that's changing. And I'm hopeful that it's changing. So I worry less now about why it's been that way, but taking encouragement from the fact that I think people are seeing when women run, when they get elected, they do a good job. It's important to have women at the table. And Marjorie agrees with that.
I do agree with that, absolutely. I'm at this table right now as
we
speak.
I agree with that, too.
But many people have argued, and I think there's some credence to this, actually. Juliet Kayyem, who's running on the Democratic ticket as well, doesn't. That two women split the women's vote. She argues that's ridiculous. It's 2014. It doesn't matter if you're a woman or not. A lot of voters are, as you say, maybe they're not in the 18th century, but they're older women who might see a woman candidate as such a big deal and would, do I vote for Juliet Kayyem? Do I vote for Martha Coakley? What do you think about that?
Well, you know, that has not been an issue in this primary. We've got five great candidates. We bring different things to it. We've got two doctors. We've got a treasurer. We've got an attorney general. We've got a homeland security expert. And people are focused on ideas in this, Marjorie. We had two great women in the race where Catherine Clark was successful. Nobody said, oh, you know, that's going to hurt. Catherine Clark won that race. And so I think that idea that we go by identity politics, you're going to split the vote, I just think that's less true. I think people care about what you stand for, what you've done, what you're going to do going forward. I see that in my race. I think I'm getting support. As my dad said, sometimes the best man for the job is a woman. And we hope in this case that'll be true. But I think voters are seeing that. They're judging people on their merits. What's their background?
You know, you talked a lot about in this campaign about increasing coverage for mental health and making more services available, et cetera. And you did something that had to be sort of painful. I didn't even know this, that your brother had committed suicide. And you put out a video that addressed that issue. Do we have sound of
that? We do. Here's a little piece of the a video that the Coakley campaign put out about a week ago.
I think we just saw, after he got out of school, deterioration. Wouldn't get treatment, wouldn't really take medication on any regular level, unable to hold a job, and really unable to sustain any relationships. It became, as somebody said, the problem with no solution.
I suspect you, knowing you a little bit, Martha Coakley, you debated whether to do that or not.
About 2 years ago, my sister Mary and I started to do a little talking about it. And we found in small groups that the more we talked about it, she's a neuropsychologist. She says one of the reasons she followed that career was she was closer in age to Edward. And she said, I started to research what was going on with him, and it made me very interested in the field. The more we've talked about it, not that it gets easier, but the way in which it resonates, Marjorie, and we say we don't want a show of hands, but everybody has a spouse, a child, a family member, a colleague, someone who suffers from depression, bipolar, schizophrenia. And the way in which we've started to say we have to reduce the stigma. We don't want families to go through what our family went through. We'd like to get more help. And people come up and say, you know, I have a child who committed suicide, but more frequently I said, you know, we have people coming up to me saying, my daughter was able to get help and she's doing quite well right now. We could do this if we get the message out. So as tough as it is sometimes, and I still, making that video was hard, I still catches me and I choke up once in a while when I'm talking about it. It was tough for Edward, it was tough for our family, for my parents, and it's tough for people living with it now. But in 2014, we should be treating mental illness the way we treat diabetes or heart disease. We have the psychiatry for it, we have the medicine for it, we don't.
You know, when you see these documentaries where men and women who have come back from fighting and putting their lives at risk,
yes,
and talk about how they couldn't admit to the fact,
exactly,
that they were suffering from PTSD, because we've heard it 1,000 times, is one thing if you break your arm, but if you have a problem in your head, which is totally understandable, there's still, it is amazing, yeah, to me that we still live with this.
But we're going to do
residue.
Better. I know that there's a will to do it, and we can do it.
Martha Coakley, you want to succeed Deval Patrick. The Department of Children and Families, he told us about a month ago that Olga Roche had offered his resignation. He rejected it.
Her resignation.
Her resignation, yeah, my okay. apologies. That he would not, doesn't see the need to start over in terms of these marijuana dispensaries, even though the rollout of the first 20 has been problematic. He even made fun of the problems with the health connector over the weekend. You've been you managed a lot of people in the Attorney General's office. You manage, obviously, a lot of people in the Middlesex County DA's office. Which part of this management thing that Deval Patrick is, and we also have the crime lab, which you know a lot about, the drug lab, et cetera. Which part has he not handled? How would you have handled any of these differently, I guess, is where I'm going.
Well, let me start with DCF, because that is an agency that I've just worked with for a long time, both in our child abuse unit, as attorney general. They have a tough, tough job. I've said that. Former commissioners have said since they were DSS, we make two mistakes. We leave kids in and we take them out. And so I've thought for a long time, and I've said this, if we had a DCF that looked at keeping families together, but a separate division within that whose responsibility was to keep track of the kids, to advocate for the kids. Are they safer at home? Is there a better place to have them? And if they are removed from the home, when, if ever, can they go back? We don't do that. And a result of which, we have a mixed message for that agency. So that is a management issue, how you structure that and how you give people a mission. I think, obviously, the preliminary reports come in. It says we need more money. That's not a surprise. We need more training. Not a surprise. Those budgets have been cut. We've been through a tough time, I believe, when I'm governor. As budgets turn around, we have more resources. There's nothing more important than doing this right and making sure that our staffs are trained, they have the supports they need, but that we also have a system that will maximize the way we keep track of and do well for a very tough population.
Has the governor failed on that count?
Look, I'm not going to judge whether he succeeded or failed. All I know is I think we need to do better.
We have an interesting email from Edward I'm going to read to you. He asks, how does Martha Coakley explain that she recently presented herself as the best candidate to go to Washington and be part of a collaborative legislative body, and now she claims to be the best candidate to be the chief executive of our state? Aren't those two very different roles and skill sets? How is that not office shopping? What do you say to Edward?
Well, first of all, I say I'm really proud of the work I've done in public service. I've served as a district attorney. I served as attorney general. In fact, people said, run for attorney general. I said, oh, I have to do utility rate regulation. Why would I want to do that? I've loved being attorney general because we've gotten to do so much great work. And, you know, one of the things with an open seat for the Senate, I felt pretty strongly back then that given what we had done around the mortgage foreclosure issues, what we had done in standing up to big banks and Wall Street, that there were a lot of issues, including immigration and better financial regulation, that I could do a good job as Senate. Look, you know, the voters thought otherwise. In fact, I said twice the voters made a decision that year to keep me as attorney general. I respect that. And I went right back to work to focus on those problems that Massachusetts has faced, keeping energy costs down, keeping our health care costs down. And so now there is an open seat for governor. I'm not, you know, job shopping. I've run for jobs that I think I can do well. We need a new governor. It's a critical time. I'm asking the voters I'm happy to stand up to all the independents, the Republican Charlie Baker, and all my Democratic colleagues, and ask the voters to vote for me.
Before you go, the last thing from me is, I think it was Joan Vernocchi, but if it wasn't, my apologies for not giving credit. Talked about mixed messages, a term you used a minute ago in another context. She, I think, argued that you were giving mixed messages on this DCF thing. At the same time that you are criticizing what isn't and how you would make changes and accommodations and where the state government is falling down, you're defending the state in your role as attorney general. So as candidate, you're saying one thing. As attorney general, you're defending the same system that you're critiquing. What's wrong with her criticism of
you? Well, first of all, it's pretty simplistic about actually what the job of any office is. I wear a particular hat as attorney general. I wear a bunch of hats as AG. One of them is when the state is sued, we take a look at that suit. We evaluate it legally on the merits, and we determine whether that case should be settled, for instance, because the plaintiffs are right, or whether the case should go to trial, or whether or what amount it should be settled in. So we act as lawyers in that respect. And I'm proud of what our office does, by and large, on those scores. In that instance, keep in mind, and everybody, you know, we understand this was about foster care. It was an outside group of attorneys that had gone to many other states and said, we have one-size-fits-all solution. This is what you should do. And by the way, we want to have a lot of attorney's fees for it. We said we believe that, you know, this case represents a chance to say, sure, we should do some things better. And I know the governor has, from the judge's decision, some things we should do better around foster care. But in this instance, the judge threw the case out on the facts and on the law. And people have left that out of the calculus. I don't see those things as contradictory at all. In fact, we've learned some things both from what we've seen in what came out of that suit. The governor has a responsibility and the ability to make that better, and so does the next governor, and I will do that.
But the judge, and correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the reasons he gave for throwing the suit out is that it didn't rise to the level of shocking the conscience. It's a term he used over and over again. So on the one hand, he was saying they're doing all these things wrong, but it doesn't shock the conscience because it's not, you know, almost premeditated mistreatment of a child. He did blast the Department of Children and Families on any number of fronts.
Well, and he's not the only one, right? Because we know, and I've acknowledged, that this agency can and should do better. But it can and should do better under the governor, the way that Massachusetts feels that we should do it, not because some outside group comes in and says, we want a federal consent order to do this thing. We know we have to improve on what we do for our foster kids. But that's different from saying, let some group outside Massachusetts come in and dictate how we improve. And by the way, we're going to charge you a lot of attorney's fees for it.
Okay. Before you go, my belief is, since NECN was broadcasting this, that they went to you and Charlie Baker and Steve Grossman said you had to shorten your bit yesterday. Is that a safe assumption?
I think we all saw us getting close to 12:30.
Okay, so whatever was the killer joke that you didn't get to use, we'd like you to share with us right now, Martha Coakley. Go ahead. What was the killer joke that you didn't use?
Oh, I can't.
Why can't you?
Well, because, you know, I had two.
We'll give you a couple extra seconds.
Yeah,
Give us the second one.
So one was, Mother Superior is on her deathbed, and this is going to go on too long for you.
No, that's fine.
So
I'm
all
into
the
this.
Sisters come around and say, sister, do you have any last wishes? And she says, all I want is some cookies and milk, Girl Scout cookies if you have them. They go out to the kitchen, and the two nuns, Sister Mary and Sister Evelyn, look around. They find some milk, and they say, you know what? There's a little bit of whiskey left. Can we give this to Mother Superior? She's on her deathbed. They put the whiskey in. They bring it into her, cookies and milk. Mother Superior sits up. She drinks the milk to the bottom of the glass. She eats the cookies. And then she says to all the nuns, they ask her, now that we've given you your last wish, can you give us some last words of wisdom? She says, don't kill that cow.
It was pretty good. It was worth the wait. Martha Coakley, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate
it. Attorney General Martha Coakley is running for governor on the Democratic ticket. She's also the woman who is not inside the Shima vest today, but she was yesterday. Thank you very much for being here.
Good to see you, Martha.
Good to see you both.
Martha Coakley.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to you too. Up next, it's all revved up. We'll get Reverend Monroe and Reverend Price's take on everything from tapping into the power of religion to drive home sales to what it means to be black on Ivy League campuses. That conversation next, 89.7 WGBH.